Chapter 5. Airmail Paper.
Will!
She spoke quietly, but he was startled all the same. She was sitting on the bench beside him, and he hadn't even noticed.
Where did you come from?
I found my scholar. She's called Dr. Malone, and she's got an engine that can see dust, and she's going to make it talk.
I didn't see you coming.
You weren't looking. You must have been thinking about something else. It's a good thing I found you. Look, it's easy to fool people. Watch.
Two police officers were strolling toward them, a man and a woman on the beat, in their white summer shirt sleeves, with their radios and their batons and their suspicious eyes. Before they reached the bench, Lyra was on her feet and speaking to them.
Please, could you tell me where the museum is? Me and my brother were supposed to meet our parents there and we got lost.
The policeman looked at Will, and Will, containing his anger, shrugged as if to say, "She's right, we're lost, isn't it silly?" The man smiled. The woman said,
"Which museum? The Ashmolean?"
"Yeah, that one,"
said Lyra, and pretended to listen carefully as the woman gave her instructions. Will got up and said,
"Thanks,"
and he and Lyra moved away together. They didn't look back, but the police had already lost interest.
"See? If they were looking for you, I put them off, because they won't be looking for someone with a sister. I better stay with you from now on,"
she went on scoldingly once they'd gone round the corner.
"You ain't safe on your own."
He said nothing. His heart was thumping with rage. They walked along towards a round building with a great leaden dome, set in a square bounded by honey-coloured stone college buildings and a church and wide-crowned trees above high garden walls. The afternoon sun drew the warmest tones out of it all, and the air felt rich with it, almost the colour itself of heavy golden wine. All the leaves were still, and in this little square even the traffic noise was hushed. She finally became aware of Will's feelings and said,
"What's the matter?"
"If you speak to people, you just attract their attention. You should just keep quiet and still, and they overlook you. I've been doing it all my life. I know how to do it. Your way, you make yourself visible. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't play at it. You're not being serious."
"You think so? You think I don't know about lying and that? I'm the best liar there ever was. But I ain't lying to you, and I never will, I swear it. You're in danger, and if I hadn't done that just then, you'd have been caught. Didn't you see them looking at you? 'Cause they were. You ain't careful enough. If you want my opinion, it's you that ain't serious."
"If I'm not serious, what am I doing hanging about waiting for you when I could be miles away, or hiding out of sight, safe in that other city? I've got my own things to do, but I'm hanging about here so I can help you. Don't tell me I'm not serious."
"You had to come through,"
she said, furious. No one should speak to her like this. She was an aristocrat. She was Lyra.
"You had to, else you'd never find out anything about your father. You'd done it for yourself, not for me."
They were quarrelling passionately, but in subdued voices, because of the quiet in the square and the people who were wandering past nearby. When she said this, though, Will stopped altogether. He had to lean against the college wall beside him. The colour had left his face.
"What do you know about my father?"
"I don't know anything. All I know is you're looking for him. That's all I asked about."
"Asked who?"
"The alethiometer, of course."
It took a moment for him to remember what she meant. And then he looked so angry and suspicious that she took it out of her rucksack and said,
"All right, I'll show you."
And she sat down on the stone curb around the grass in the middle of the square and bent her head over the golden instrument and began to turn the hands, her fingers moving almost too quickly to see, and then pausing for several seconds while the slender needle whipped around the dial, flicking to a stop here and there, and then turning the hands to new positions just as quickly. Will looked around carefully, but there was no one near to see. A group of tourists looked up at the domed building, an ice cream vendor wheeled his cart along the pavement, but their attention was elsewhere. Lyra blinked and sighed as if she were waking after a sleep.
"Your mother's ill, but she's safe. There's this lady looking after her. And you took some letters and ran away. And there was a man. I think he was a thief, and you killed him. And you're looking for your father, and..."
"All right, shut up. That's enough. You've got no right to look into my life like that. Don't ever do that again. That's just spying."
"I know when to stop asking. See, the alethiometer's like a person, almost. I sort of know when it's going to be cross, or when there's things it doesn't want me to know. I kind of feel it. But when you come out of nowhere yesterday, I had to ask it who you were, or I might not have been safe. I had to. And it said you was a murderer. And I thought, Good. That's all right. He's someone I can trust. But I didn't ask more than that till just now. And if you don't want me to ask any more, I promise I won't. This ain't like a private peep show. If I'd done nothing but spy on people, it'd stop working. I know that as well as I know my own Oxford.
You could have asked me instead of that thing. Did it say whether my father was alive or dead?
No, because I didn't ask.
They were both sitting by this time. Will put his head in his hands with weariness.
Well, I suppose we'll have to trust each other.
That's all right. I trust you.
Will nodded grimly. He was so tired and there was not the slightest possibility of sleep in this world. Lyra wasn't usually so perceptive, but something in his manner made her think. He's afraid, but he's mastering his fear, like Yorick Birnison said we had to do, like I did by the fish house at the frozen lake.
And Will, I won't give you away. Not to anyone, I promise.
Good.
I'd done that before. I betrayed someone. And it was the worst thing I ever did. I thought I was saving his life, actually. Only I was taking him right to the most dangerous place there could be. I hated myself for that, for being so stupid. So I'll try very hard not to be careless or forget and betray you.
He said nothing. He rubbed his eyes and blinked hard to try and wake himself up.
We can't go back through the window till much later. We shouldn't have come through in daylight anyway. We can't risk anyone seeing. And now we've got to hang around for hours.
I'm hungry.
I know. We can go to the cinema.
The what?
I'll show you. We can get some food there too.
There was a cinema near the city centre, 10 minutes walk away. Will paid for both of them to get in and bought hot dogs and popcorn and coke, and they carried the food inside and sat down just as the film was beginning. Lyra was entranced. She had seen projected photograms, but nothing in her world had prepared her for the cinema. She wolfed down the hot dog and the popcorn, gulped the Coca-Cola, and gasped and laughed with delight at the characters on the screen. Luckily, it was a noisy audience full of children, and her excitement wasn't conspicuous. Will closed his eyes at once and went to sleep. He woke when he heard the clatter of seats as people moved out, and blinked in the light. His watch showed 8:15. Lyra came away reluctantly.
That's the best thing I ever saw in my whole life. I don't know why they never invented this in my world. We got some things better than you, but this was better than anything we got.
Will couldn't even remember what the film had been. It was still light outside and the streets were busy.
Do you want to see another one?
Yeah.
So they went to the next cinema, a few hundred yards away around the corner, and did it again. Lyra settled down with her feet on the seat, hugging her knees, and Will let his mind go blank. When they came out this time, it was nearly 11 o'clock. Much better. Lyra was hungry again, so they bought hamburgers from a cart and ate them as they walked along. Something else new to her.
We always sit down to eat. I've never seen people just walking along eating before. There's so many ways this place is different. The traffic, for one. I don't like it. I like the cinema, though, and hamburgers. I like them a lot. And that scholar, Dr. Malone, she's going to make that engine use words. I just know she is. I'll go back there tomorrow and see how she's getting on. I bet I could help her. I could probably get the scholars to give her the money she wants, too. You know how my father did it, Lord Asriel. He played a trick on them.
As they walked up the Banbury Road, she told him about the night she hid in the wardrobe and watched Lord Asriel show the Jordan scholars the severed head of Stanislaus Grumman in the vacuum flask. And since Will was such a good audience, she went on and told him the rest of her story, from the time she escaped from Mrs. Coulter's flat to the horrible moment when she realized she'd led Roger to his death on the icy cliffs of Svalbard. Will listened without comment, but attentively, with sympathy. Her account of a voyage in a balloon, of armored bears and witches, of a vengeful arm of the church, seemed all of a piece with his own fantastic dream of a beautiful city on the sea, empty and silent and safe. It couldn't be true. It was as simple as that. But eventually they reached the ring road and the hornbeam trees. There was very little traffic now, a car every minute or so, no more than that. And there was the window. Will felt himself smiling. It was going to be all right.
Wait till there's no cars coming. I'm going through now.
And a moment later he was on the grass under the palm trees, and a second or two afterwards Lyra followed. They felt as if they were home again. The wide, warm night, and the scent of flowers and the sea, and the silence, bathed them like soothing water. Lyra stretched and yawned, and Will felt a great weight lift off his shoulders. He had been carrying it all day, and he hadn't noticed how it had nearly pressed him into the ground. But now he felt light and free and at peace. And then Lyra gripped his arm. In the same second he heard what had made her do it. Somewhere in the little streets beyond the cafe, something was screaming. Will set off at once towards the sound, and Lyra followed behind as he plunged down a narrow alley shadowed from the moonlight. After several twists and turns, they came out into the square in front of the stone tower they'd seen that morning. 20 or so children were facing inwards in a semicircle at the base of the tower, and some of them had sticks in their hands, and some were throwing stones at whatever they had trapped against the wall. At first Lyra thought it was another child, but coming from inside the semicircle was a horrible high wailing that wasn't human at all. And the children were screaming too, in fear as well as hatred. Will ran up to the children and pulled the first one back. It was a boy of about his own age, a boy in a striped T-shirt. As he turned, Lyra saw the wild white rims around his pupils, and then the other children realized what was happening and stopped to look. Angelica and her little brother were there too, stones in hand, and all the children's eyes glittered fiercely in the moonlight. They fell silent. Only the high wailing continued, and then both Will and Lyra saw what it was, a tabby cat, cowering against the wall of the tower, its ear torn and its tail bent. It was the cat Will had seen in Sunderland Avenue, the one like Moxie, the one that had led him to the window. As soon as he saw her, he flung aside the boy he was holding. The boy fell to the ground and was up in a moment, furious, but the others held him back. Will was already kneeling by the cat, and then she was in his arms. She fled to his breast, and he cradled her close and stood to face the children, and Lyra thought for a crazy second that his demon had appeared at last.
"What are you hurting this cat for?"
he demanded, and they couldn't answer. They stood trembling at Will's anger, breathing heavily, clutching their sticks and their stones, and they couldn't speak. But then Angelica's voice came clearly.
"You ain't from here. You ain't from Jagadza. You didn't know about specters. You don't know about cats either. You ain't like us."
The boy in the striped T-shirt whom Will had thrown down was trembling to fight, and if it hadn't been for the cat in Will's arms, he would have flown at Will with fists and teeth and feet, and Will would have gladly joined battle. There was a current of electric hatred between the two of them that only violence could ground, but the boy was afraid of the cat.
"Where you come from?"
"Doesn't matter where we come from. If you're scared of this cat, I'll take her away from you. If she's bad luck to you, she'll be good luck for us. Now get out of the way!"
For a moment, Will thought their hatred would overcome their fear, and he was preparing to put the cat down and fight. But then came a low, thunderous growl from behind the children, and they turned to see Lyra standing with her hand on the shoulders of a great spotted leopard, whose teeth shone white as he snarled. Even Will, who recognized Pantalaimon, was frightened for a second. Its effect on the children was dramatic. They turned and fled at once. A few seconds later, the square was empty. But before they left, Lyra looked up at the tower. A growl from Pantalaimon prompted her, and just briefly she saw someone there on the very top, looking down over the battlemented rim. And not a child either, but a young man with curly hair. Half an hour later they were in the flat above the cafe. Will had found a tin of condensed milk, and the cat had lapped it hungrily and then begun to lick her wounds. Pantalaimon had become cat-formed out of curiosity, and at first the tabby cat had bristled with suspicion, but she soon realized that whatever Pantalaimon was, he was neither a true cat nor a threat, and proceeded to ignore him. Lyra watched Will tending this one with fascination. The only animals she'd been close to in her world, apart from the armored bears, were working animals of one sort or another. Cats were for keeping Jordan College clear of mice, not for making pets of.
"Oh, I think her tail's broken. I don't know what to do about that. Maybe it'll heal by itself. I'll put some honey on her ear. I read about that somewhere. It's antiseptic."
It was messy, but at least it kept her occupied, licking it off, and the wound was getting cleaner all the time.
"You sure this is the one you saw?"
"Oh, yes. And if they're all so frightened of cats, there wouldn't be many in this world anyway. She probably couldn't find her way back."
"They were just crazy. They would have killed her. I've never seen kids being like that."
"I have."
But his face had closed. He didn't want to talk about it, and she knew better than to ask. She knew she wouldn't even ask the alethiometer. She was very tired, so presently she went to bed and slept at once. A little later, when the cat had curled up to sleep, Will took a cup of coffee and the green leather writing case and sat on the balcony. There was enough light coming through the window for him to read by, and he wanted to look at the papers. There weren't many. As he thought, they were letters written on airmail paper in black ink. These very marks were made by the hand of the man he wanted so much to find. He moved his fingers over and over them and pressed them to his face, trying to get closer to the essence of his father. Then he started to read.
Fairbanks, Alaska. Wednesday, 19th of June, 1985. My darling, the usual mixture of efficiency and chaos. All the stores are here, but the physicist, a genial dimwit called Nelson, hasn't made any arrangements for carrying his damn balloons up into the mountains, having to twiddle our thumbs while he scrabbles around for transport. But it means I had a chance to talk to an old boy I met last time, a gold miner called Jake Peterson. Tracked him down to a dingy bar, and under the sound of the baseball game on the TV, I asked him about the anomaly. He wouldn't talk there, took me back to his apartment. With the help of a bottle of Jack Daniels, he talked for a long time. Hadn't seen it himself, but he'd met an Eskimo who had, and this chap said it was a doorway into the spirit world. They'd known about it for centuries. Part of the initiation of a medicine man involved going through and bringing back a trophy of some kind, though some never came back. However, old Jake did have a map of the area, and he'd marked on it where his pal had told him the thing was. Just in case, it's at 69 degrees, 2 minutes, 11 seconds north, 157 degrees, 12 minutes, 19 seconds west, on a spur of Lookout Ridge, a mile or two north of the Colville River. We then got on to other Arctic legends, the Norwegian ship that's been drifting unmanned for 60 years, stuff like that. The archaeologists are a decent crew, keen to get to work, containing their impatience with Nelson and his balloons. None of them has ever heard of the anomaly, and believe me, I'm going to keep it like that. My fondest love to you both. Johnny. Umiat, Alaska. Saturday, 22nd of June, 1985. My darling. So much for, what did I call him, a genial dimwit? The physicist Nelson is nothing of the sort, and if I'm not mistaken, he's actually looking for the anomaly himself. The hold-up in Fairbanks was orchestrated by him, would you believe? Knowing that the rest of the team wouldn't want to wait for anything less than an unarguable reason like no transport, he personally sent ahead and cancelled the vehicles that had been ordered. I found this out by accident, and I was going to ask him what the hell he was playing at, when I overheard him talking on the radio to someone, describing the anomaly, no less, except he didn't know the location. Later on, I brought him a drink, played the bluff soldier, old Arctic hand, more things in heaven and earth line. Pretended to tease him with the limitations of science, bet you can't explain Bigfoot, etc., watching him closely. Then sprung the anomaly on him. Eskimo legend of a doorway into spirit world. Invisible. Somewhere near Lookout Ridge, would you believe? Where we're heading for, fancy that. And you know he was jolted rigid. He knew exactly what I meant. I pretended not to notice and went on to witchcraft, told him the Zaire leopard story. So I hope he's got me down as a superstitious military blockhead. But I'm right, Elaine. He's looking for it too. The question is, do I tell him or not? Got to work out what his game is. Fondest love to both. Johnny. Colville Bar, Alaska. Monday, 24th of June, 1985. Darling, I won't get a chance to post another letter for a while. This is the last town before we take to the hills, the Brooks Range. The archaeologists are fizzing to get up there. One chap is convinced he'll find evidence of much earlier habitation than anyone suspected. I said, how much earlier, and why was he convinced? He told me of some narwhal ivory carvings he'd found on a previous dig, carbon-14 dated to some incredible age, way outside the range of what was previously assumed. Anomalous, in fact. Wouldn't it be strange if they'd come through my anomaly from some other world? Talking of which, the physicist Nelson is my closest buddy now, kids me along, drops hints to imply that he knows that I know that he knows, etc., and I pretend to be bluff Major Parry, stout fellow in a crisis, but not too much between the ears, what? But I know he's after it. For one thing, although he's a bona fide academic, his funding actually comes from the Ministry of Defense. I know the financial codes they use. And for another, his so-called weather balloons are nothing of the sort. I looked in the crate. A radiation suit, if ever I've seen one. A rum do, my darling. I shall stick to my plan. Take the archaeologists to their spot, and go off by myself for a few days to look for the anomaly. If I bump into Nelson wandering about on Lookout Ridge, I'll play it by ear. Later, a real bit of luck. I met Jake Peterson's pal, the Eskimo, Matt Kigalik. Jake had told me where to find him, but I hadn't dared to hope he'd be there. He told me the Soviets had been looking for the anomaly, too. He'd come across a man earlier this year, high up in the range, and watched him for a couple of days without being seen, because he guessed what he was doing, and he was right. And the man turned out to be Russian, a spy. He didn't tell me more than that. I got the impression he'd bumped him off. But he described the thing to me. It's like a gap in the air, a sort of window. You look through it, and you see another world. But it's not easy to find, because that part of the other world looks just like this, rocks and moss and so forth. It's on the north side of a small creek, 50 paces or so to the west of a tall rock shaped like a standing bear. And the position Jake gave me is not quite right. It's nearer 12 seconds north than 11. Wish me luck, my darling. I'll bring you back a trophy from the spirit world. I love you forever. Kiss the boy for me. Johnny.
Will found his head ringing. His father was describing exactly what he himself had found under the hornbeam trees. He, too, had found a window. He even used the same word for it. So Will must be on the right track. And this knowledge was what the men had been searching for. So it was dangerous, too. Will had been just a baby when that letter was written. 7 years after that had come the morning in the supermarket when he realized his mother was in terrible danger and he had to protect her. And then slowly in the months that followed came his growing realization that the danger was in her mind and he had to protect her all the more. And then, brutally, the revelation that not all the danger had been in her mind after all. There really was someone after her, after these letters, this information. He had no idea what it meant, but he felt deeply happy that he had something so important to share with his father. That John Parry and his son Will had each, separately, discovered this extraordinary thing. When they met, they could talk about it, and his father would be proud that Will had followed in his footsteps. The night was quiet and the sea was still. He folded the letters away and fell asleep.
Chapter 6. Lighted Flyers.
Grumman,
said the black-bearded fur trader.
From the Berlin Academy? Reckless. I met him 5 years back, over at the northern end of the Urals. I thought he was dead.
Sam Cansino, an old acquaintance and a Texan like Lee Scoresby, sat in the naphtha-laden smoky bar of the Samyursky Hotel and tossed back a shot glass of bitingly cold vodka. He nudged the plate of pickled fish and black bread towards Lee, who took a mouthful and nodded for Sam to tell him more.
He'd walked into a trap that fool Yakov Lev laid and cut his leg open to the bone. Instead of using regular medicines, he insisted on using the stuff the bears use, blood moss, some kind of lichen. It ain't a true moss. Anyway, he was lying on a sledge, alternately roaring with pain and calling out instructions to his men. They were taking star sights, and they had to get the measurements right, or he'd lash them with his tongue. And boy, he had a tongue like barbed wire. A lean man, tough, powerful, curious about everything. You know, he was a Tartar by initiation.
You don't say,
said Lee Scoresby, tipping more vodka into Sam's glass. His demon, Hester, crouched at his elbow on the bar, eyes half closed as usual, ears flat along her back. Lee had arrived that afternoon, borne to Nova Zembla by the wind the witches had called up, and once he'd stowed his equipment, he'd made straight for the Samyursky Hotel, near the fish-packing station. This was a place where many Arctic drifters stopped to exchange news or look for employment or leave messages for one another, and Lee Scoresby had spent several days there in the past, waiting for a contract or a passenger or a fair wind, so there was nothing unusual in his conduct now. And with the vast changes they sensed in the world around them, it was natural for people to gather and talk. With every day that passed came more news. The river Yenisei was free of ice, and at this time of year, too. Part of the ocean had drained away, exposing strange regular formations of stone on the seabed. A squid 100 feet long had snatched 3 fishermen out of their boat and torn them apart. And the fog continued to roll in from the north, dense and cold and occasionally drenched with the strangest imaginable light, in which great forms could be vaguely seen and mysterious voices heard. Altogether it was a bad time to work, which was why the bar of the Samirsky Hotel was full.
"Did you say Grewman?"
said the man sitting just along the bar, an elderly man in seal hunter's rig, whose lemming demon looked out solemnly from his pocket.
"He was a Tartar, all right. I was there when he joined that tribe. I saw him having his skull drilled. He had another name, too, a Tartar name. I'll think of it in a minute."
"Well, how about that? Let me buy you a drink, my friend. I'm looking for news of this man. What tribe was it he joined?"
"The Yenisei Partas, at the foot of the Semyonov Range, near a fork of the Yenisei and the, I forget what it's called, a river that comes down from the hills. There's a rock the size of a house at the landing stage."
Sure, I remember it now. I've flown over it. And Grewman had his skull drilled, you say? Why was that?"
"He was a shaman. I think the tribe recognized him as a shaman before they adopted him. Some business, that drilling. It goes on for 2 nights of the day. They use a bow drill, like for lighting a fire."
"Ah, that accounts for the way his team was obeying him. They were the roughest bunch of scoundrels I ever saw, but they ran around doing his bidding like nervous children. I thought it was his cursing that did it. If they thought he was a shaman, it'd make even more sense. But you know, that man's curiosity was as powerful as a wolf's jaws. He would not let go. He made me tell him every scrap I knew about the land thereabouts and the habits of wolverines and foxes. And he was in some pain from that damn trap of Yakovlev's, leg laid open. And he was writing the results of that blood moss, taking his temperature, watching the scar form, making notes on every damn thing. A strange man. There was a witch who wanted him for a lover, but he turned her down." "Is that so?"
said Lee, thinking of the beauty of Serafina Pekala.
"He shouldn't have done that. A witch offers you her love, you should take it. If you don't, it's your own fault if bad things happen to you. It's like having to make a choice, a blessing or a curse. The one thing you can't do is choose neither."
"He might have had a reason."
"If he had any sense, it will have been a good one."
"He was headstrong. Maybe faithful to another woman. I heard something else about him. I heard he knew the whereabouts of some magic object, I don't know what it might be, that could protect anyone who held it. Did you ever hear that story?"
"Yes, I heard that. He didn't have it himself, but he knew where it was. There was a man who tried to make him tell, but Grewman killed him."
"His demon, now that was curious. She was an eagle, a black eagle with a white head and breast, of a kind I'd never set eyes on. And I didn't know how she might be called."
"She was an osprey,"
said the barman, listening in.
"You're talking about Stan Grewman? His demon was an osprey. A fish eagle."
"What happened to him?"
"Oh, he got mixed up in the Skraeling Wars over at Bering Land. Last I heard, he'd been shot. Killed outright."
"I heard they beheaded him."
"No, you're both wrong. And I know, because I heard it from an Inuit who was with him. Seems that they were camped out on Sakhalin somewhere, and there was an avalanche. Grewman was buried under 100 tons of rock. This Inuit saw it happen."
"What I can't understand,"
said Lee Scoresby, offering the bottle round,
"is what the man was doing. Was he prospecting for rock oil, maybe? Or was he a military man? Or was it something philosophical? You said something about measurements, Sam. What would that be?"
"They were measuring the starlight and the aurora. He had a passion for the aurora. I think his main interest was in ruins, though. Ancient thing."
"I know who could tell you more. Up the mountain they have an observatory belonging to the Imperial Muscovite Academy. They'd be able to tell you. I know he went up there more than once."
"What do you want to know for, anyway, Lee?" "He owes me some money."
This explanation was so satisfying that it stopped their curiosity at once. The conversation turned to the topic on everyone's lips, the catastrophic changes taking place around them which no one could see.
The fishermen, they say you can sail right up into that new world.
There's a new world?
As soon as this damn fog clears, we'll see right into it. When it first happened, I was out in my kayak and looking north, just by chance. I'll never forget what I saw. Instead of the earth curving down over the horizon, it went straight on. I could see forever. And as far as I could see, there was land and shoreline, mountains, harbors, green trees and fields of corn, forever into the sky. I tell you, friends, that was something worth toiling 50 years to see. A sight like that. I would have paddled up the sky into that calm sea without a backward glance. But then came the fog.
Ain't never seen a fog like this. Reckon it set in for a month, maybe more. But you're out of luck if you want money from Stanislaus Grumman, Lee. The man's dead.
I got his Tartar name. I just remembered what they called him during the drilling. It sounded like Jopari.
Jopari? That's no kind of name I've ever heard of. Might be Nipponese, I suppose. Well, if I want my money, maybe I can chase up his heirs and assigns. Or maybe the Berlin Academy can square the debt. I'll go ask at the observatory, see if they have an address I can apply to.
The observatory was some distance to the north, and Lee Scoresby hired a dog sledge and driver. It wasn't easy to find someone willing to risk the journey in the fog, but Lee was persuasive, or his money was. And eventually an old Tartar from the Ob region agreed to take him there, after a lengthy bout of haggling. The driver didn't rely on a compass, or he would have found it impossible. He navigated by other signs, his Arctic fox demon for one, who sat at the front of the sledge keenly scenting the way. Lee, who carried his compass everywhere, had realized already that the Earth's magnetic field was as disturbed as everything else. The old driver said, as they stopped to brew coffee,
"This happened before, this thing."
"What, the sky opening? That happened before?"
"Many thousand generation. My people remember. All long time ago. Many thousand generation."
"What did they say about it?"
"Sky fall open, and spirits move between this world and that world. All the lands move. The ice melt, then freeze again. The spirits close up the hole after a while, seal it up. But witches say the sky is thin there behind the northern lights."
"What's going to happen, Umak?"
"Same thing as before. Make all same again. But only after big trouble. Big war. Spirit war."
The driver wouldn't tell him any more, and soon they moved on, tracking slowly over undulations and hollows and past outcrops of dim rock, dark through the pallid fog, until the old man said,
"Observatory, up there. You walk now. Path too crooked for sledge. You won't go back. I wait here."
"Yeah, I want to go back when I've finished, Umak. You make yourself a fire, my friend, and sit and rest a spell. I'll be 3-4 hours, maybe."